From WBUR Boston, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, we have a lecture by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture is titled Kristallnacht. Introducing Professor Wiesel is Boston University President Emeritus John Silber.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Job observed that as the cloud is consumed and vanisheth away, so he that goeth down to Sheol shall come up no more. He shall return no more to his house, neither shall his place know him any more. The meaning of Job's words is unmistakable and must never be forgotten. If you are dead, there is no more place for you. Or put it another way, if you have no place of your own, you are dead. That is, having some place of one's own is essential to life. And he who would take away your place will also take away your life. This, in a nutshell, is the justification for the existence of Israel. The state of Israel became necessary when all of the countries of Europe participated either willingly or not in the Holocaust, or elsewhere, as in the United States, refused Jews entry even when they were refugees from Europe and had no other place to go. One can always trade land for peace, as Israel has been willing to do, but the Israelis cannot trade all their land for peace, for it would be a land and a peace without Jews. It is my greatest pleasure this evening to introduce for the 32nd time Elie Wiesel, Nobel Laureate for Peace, University Professor, and Andrew Mellon Professor of the Humanities at Boston University. The title of Professor Wiesel's lecture tonight is Kristallnacht, the night nearly 70 years ago when Germany was convulsed by state-sponsored riots that drove German Jews from their homes, synagogues, and businesses. Kristallnacht was the night that presaged the years of night that, in retrospect, have been named the Shoah, the Holocaust. Elie Wiesel has made certain through his speeches, conversations, books, and steadfast witness that mankind shall never forget the effort that was made to deny Jews a place in which to live. The resources of a powerful nation and all its allies were directed to the Jews' extermination. Elie Wiesel's witness ensures that none of this can be forgotten. Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass, was one of the Nazis' first acts of state-sponsored violence against Jews that led to the death camps and culminated in the Holocaust. Juden aus was the cry. Jews out. Their place was no longer protected by their rights as German citizens or by their claims as human beings. Kristallnacht made clear that Jews had no rights, and that included no right to a place of their own. Jews were not threatened with death at first, but as Job knew, when they were threatened with the loss of place, it would inevitably lead to an end in death. Elie Wiesel was 10 years old and living in a small Romanian village when the fury of Kristallnacht broke first. By coincidence, another Romanian was traveling through Berlin on his way to Paris that very same November night. Paul Anschel saw the smoke rising from the ruins of Berlin's Jewish community, and this vision drew him to poetry. We know him now as not Paul Anschel, but by his pen name, Paul Celan. And in his memories of Kristallnacht, we hear the warnings of what those first fires foretold. "You came at the Anhalter railroad station," he writes, and he later remembered, "a smoke flowed toward your glance. It already belonged to tomorrow." In the smoke and ashes of November 1938, Paul Celan saw intimations of the turmoil and death to come. Do we see telltales today of new horrors that tomorrow could destroy the Jews? In speech after speech, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has made perfectly clear what he wishes to accomplish with the nuclear weapons he seeks. In 2005, he praised former Iranian Ayatollah Khomeini for proclaiming that the occupying regime of Israel must be wiped off the map. When the world decried his threat, Ahmadinejad coyly suggested that he did not have genocide in mind, but rather thought that Israel would dissolve as Palestinians reasserted their rights. But Ahmadinejad cannot disguise his yearnings to see the Jewish people dislodged, displaced, and destroyed. In 2006, he organized a pseudo-academic conference that questioned whether the Holocaust had ever happened. When Ahmadinejad calls the state of Israel, and I'm quoting, of course, a stinking corpse, a dead rat, a fake and criminal regime, only the willfully blind can ignore the smoke rising from his smoldering words. Thankfully, Elie Wiesel will not allow the world to ignore the threat Ahmadinejad poses. This September, he boldly struggled to rally world opinion against the Iranian president. As Ahmadinejad was about to address the General Assembly, Elie Wiesel called on the UN's diplomats to boycott his address. Elie demanded that the world unite to stop Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons and that the Iranian president be stopped before he could make good on his threats. Ahmadinejad, Elie said, and I quote, is a threat to world peace and he should not be here in New York. His place is in a United Nations prison cell. Although Elie was successful in calling public attention to the scandal of Ahmadinejad's presence, the diplomats of the United Nations did not heed Elie's call to turn their backs on him. Nor has the world yet punished the Iranian regime for defiantly enriching uranium. The threat to the state of Israel remains imminent. Thanks to Elie's persistent defense of memory against the forces of forgetting, we can hope that Israel and her friends remember the cost of acquiescing to those thugs who would deny any people its place. Like Elie Wiesel, the poet Paul Celan was eventually imprisoned in a Nazi concentration camp. There he witnessed death he had foreseen. In his poem, Todesfuge, or Fugue of Death, Celan recalls a camp commandant who promises his Jewish prisoners a grave beyond this earth. A grave you will have in the clouds, the commandant proclaims. There one lies unconfined. I hope we know our duty. We must defend a place for Jews, not in the clouds, but on this earth. In the light of the historic context, the state of Israel is more than amply justified. It is, in fact, a classic example of self-defense, a people's determination to preserve a place for themselves, to ensure their own existence. Individual Jews will die, but the Jewish people will not go down into Sheol. They and we will defend their place. Elie once remarked that life is made up of moments, not of years. Elie Wiesel's lectures are among the most precious moments of our lives, moments that take on ever greater meaning through the passage of years. Ladies and gentlemen, Elie Wiesel.
The situation is, as you heard, a state-sponsored pogrom. But the topic actually could be defined differently. It is all about vengeance. Just that, vengeance. This is the moral question. Does an individual man or woman have the right, on their own, without consulting any political or moral authority, to commit an individual act that could endanger and harm others, many others, even their entire people? Granted, they may obey the voice of their conscience, but is that enough a reason? It happened, as you heard, nearly 70 years ago. In the fall of 1938, in Paris, a young Jewish adolescent, thinking he could accomplish the unknown will of Jewish history, entered it with sound and fury. Herschel Greenspan saw himself in the role of prosecutor, judge, and avenger. Thus he felt it was incumbent upon him to execute or kill a German diplomat. His deed caused the shedding of Jewish blood in a land where the enemies of our people were looking for a pretext to publicly curse, defame, ostracize, terrorize, torment, punish, humiliate, rob, and destroy a Jewish community, which was then already the loneliest and the most threatened in the world. The event has since been cynically and poetically known as the Night of the Broken Glass, Kristallnacht, or Kristallnacht. Yes, it happened in Hitler's Germany, where Joseph Goebbels, the genius of evil hatred, whose underlings always managed to find grandiose and lofty words to better hide unspeakable atrocities. Was Herschel Greenspan right in allowing his wrath to become an act of vengeance? The question related to Herschel Greenspan actually would be addressed, could be addressed, to one of our ancient heroes, Mordechai HaTzadik, Mordechai the Just. During the time of Purim in Persia, years, centuries and centuries ago. Now Mordechai, hasn't he in a way been Herschel Greenspan's pathfinder or forerunner or example? Remember, in those times, what we hear, what we know from the text and the commentaries, Jews had a good life in the capital city of Persia, Shushan. Nobody threatened them. Nobody maligned them. They were respected citizens of a huge empire. Some dignitaries had useful connections in the highest places. They were honored guests at what was then the White House, the Imperial Palace, for a very festive dinner. When King Ahasuerus decided to organize a great event, they were invited, and they came, and they enjoyed themselves. All was well. There was no anti-Semitism, nothing, no propaganda, no articles in the press, no demonstrations against Jews. All was well when a certain Haman rose to power, and he was, if he was an anti-Semite, no one knew about it. That was not the reason why he was elected or nominated by the emperor. There was nothing in his political or social program to indicate that he hated Jews. No special anti-Jewish legislation, no synagogue was burned, no school closed, no discrimination, no quotas, nothing. But then something happened. Haman, in his grandiose ambitions, issued a decree forcing all the inhabitants, all Jews and non-Jews alike, to bow before him. He didn't single out the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It affected everyone in the 127 provinces. And then Mordechai appeared on the stage out of nowhere. Mordechai was a loyal and proud Jew. He obeyed the law of Moses and simply therefore refused to bow before any arrogant human being. It's against the law. God alone is the sovereign. Normally, he could have practiced his Judaism at home, with his family, behind closed doors, in private, avoiding the environment around the royal palace. But no, he had to show his audacity. So he went to public places to be seen by all the people who entered the gates. Did he at least hide when Haman arrived? No, quite the opposite. He wanted to be seen by Haman. Now, why did he do that? Why did he behave like that? Didn't he know that the new all-powerful ruler would be hurt, offended, angry, and he is dangerous? And that, as always, other fellow Jews might suffer on his account? Who gave him the idea to go that far? Who gave him the right to endanger the lives of other Jews? And the answer, maybe, is that Haman wanted to impose idolatry to his subjects. And idolatry is one of the three cardinal sins in our tradition. One may not transgress, even if it means death. So it has a special prerogative. But on a different level, Mordechai interpreted idolatry as an assault on Jewish honor. And therefore he felt he had a right to risk his own life to preserve it. When Jewish honor is at stake, then other measures are necessary. But then again, what about the consequences? We shall, of course, continue to this. But first, let me open our custom is some parentheses. And I want to greet, of course, President and Mrs. Brown for being here tonight. President Brown, you are now the president of a very great and marvelous university, one of the best in the country. I go around the country to many universities. Never has the prestige of our university been so high. Never have so many students shown their ardor, their desire to come and study. Never have our faculties, the deans, the students, the professors been really so committed, so good. You should be very proud of what is being happening here. Then, of course, thank you to my introductor annually, Dr. John Silber. I always learn something from what you say. And tonight, even more so, the connection between the past and the present, the dangers that threaten not only one people, I believe all people. When one people is threatened, all are affected. And if some of us really are so determined to prevent nuclear proliferation, in certain places, surely, where dictatorship prevails, that was the reason we have learned something from our own memory and from history. Of course, the topic, as I said, is vengeance. Though vengeance is not too frequent in the Bible, we know still that there were acts of vengeance. You remember the story of Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and she was raped by the prince of Shechem. She was raped, and then Shimon and Levi, her two brothers, became avengers. It's an extraordinary story because Jacob himself opposed his own children. He denounced their act. Vengeance. Of course, those who commit vengeance do it in the name of justice. But are justice and vengeance related only as cause and consequence? Are they at all compatible? Is an act of individual or collective vengeance an expression of a thirst for justice? Can it be? Must it be? Does one atone for the other? Or is the one eliminated by the other? That would be the basic question. When is vengeance ethical? Is it ever? Can it be? For Christians, all answers are anchored in one major response, love. For Jews, justice prevails. Does it exclude vengeance? It doesn't, since it may be a momentary human passion or impulse. In other words, whether calculated or impulsive, vengeance is to be examined, not as a response to injustice, but as a possibility to be weighed. But then, we are told, Kein nekamot ad Hashem. God is a God of vengeance. And I was wondering, why do the text insist on that? That God is vengeance. God? God, the judge of all judges? God, the compassionate? Vengeance? And then, in order to try a kind of explanation, I came back to the Haggadah of the Passover story, where somehow the text in the Bible already insists. Passover, you remember, Passover was finally the last punishment inflicted on Pharaoh was when all the firstborn were killed that night, including the children. And the text says, when God says, I did it, I, God, not through a messenger, not through an angel, I did it. And I was wondering, why is God boasting about it? What is the big boast? Killing children? Be it enemy children? Can children be enemies? Why is he boasting? And then I think I understood the possible explanation. God says, to kill children, you should never do that. I can do it. But not you. No person should ever, ever be in a position or put himself or herself in a position to kill children. I can do it. So, not you. The same is vengeance. Vengeance, okay. Sometimes it's important. I will do it. Not you. Vengeance should not be an option. And yet. So let's go back to the context of the Kristallnacht. Politically and militarily, 1938, the Third Reich is getting stronger in its resolve and more arrogant in its ambitions. Anti-Semitism has become the official state policy, both in its propaganda and in its national goals. Having obtained what it considered international respectability with the Olympic Games in 1936, diminished the Jewish problem on its list of priorities during that year. But later, immediately later, the moment the Games were over, ancestral and racist hatred of Jews and against Jews was revived and broadened. Deprived of their civil and human rights, they could not expect official protection from any quarter. Usually in any democracy, in any civilized land, I, if assaulted, if in danger, can run from the enemy to be protected by the police. But what do you do when the police is the enemy? When the police is the danger? When the police is the threat? When it is the police who wants to kill me, or at least to torture me, or to inflict all kinds of suffering on me? What do you do then? Now, physicians, functionaries, engineers, architects, and lawyers were excluded from all government positions. Remember, when Jewish professors were dismissed, not a single colleague rose in their defense. The same happened to physicians and lawyers. The first association to join the Nazi Party was the Medical Association. But in general, there was absolutely no reaction from within. Hitler and Goebbels and Himmler could do what they wanted. It's quite simple. Separated from the general community, all Jews were condemned, then already, to dwell in a kind of invisible ghettos. In Munich, Dortmund, and Nuremberg. Already then, before Kristallnacht, synagogues were expropriated. Here and there, Jewish notables and dignitaries were forced to tear out the grass with their teeth. Faced with such brutality, where could Jews turn for help? And so Jewish communities in Germany, among the oldest in Europe, in Germany where for a time there was a symbiosis between Jews and Gentiles, there was a time when the symbiosis was almost unparalleled in modern history. But then, under Hitler, it was different. The Jewish communities all over Germany lived in the fear of unknown. What to do in order to disarm the danger? To whom to appeal for help? Naturally, common sense advised departure, or at least preparation to leave everything behind and go elsewhere, anywhere. But that wasn't easy, neither psychologically nor practically, since all borders were closed. Some Jews were ready to go, but where? Nobody wanted them. America had a quota, and Palestine was under the rigorous British mandate. No country was eager to welcome refugees, and surely not Jewish refugees. So the choice was between being helpless at home and stateless abroad. Already then, when world leaders felt the need to do something that they didn't want to do, they initiated conferences. So did President Roosevelt, understandably moved by what would become a tragedy of unprecedented proportions of massive immigration. He decided to organize an international gathering of four refugees, on refugees. Evian in France, a spa, was chosen as the site for the event. 32 nations participated in it. The sessions lasted from July 6th to July 15th, filled with speeches and more speeches. In truth, in retrospect, when we study the texts, the whole endeavor was a depressing farce, a historical joke and a moral disaster. Rather than look for havens for the uprooted persons, they were abandoned to their fate. Every national representative took the floor to invoke a variety of excuses explaining why his or her country could not and would not welcome Jewish refugees. NGO representatives, Zionist and Jewish, were also present. The delegate of the World Jewish Congress got 5 minutes. The envoy of German Jewish communities, none. The international press reported correctly on the event. The New York Herald Tribune ran an article under the headline, "Exiled Jews Refused by All in Evian." In Germany, Goebbels' publications jubilate. Listen to a gigantic headline in the journal Reichswart. Jews offered at a low price. Any buyer? As for the Danziger for Boston, it simply declares that the Evian Conference justified Germany's policy towards Jews. The best and friendliest countries in the world, with very rare exceptions, closed their gates and their hearts to the plight of German Jews. The sacred principle of immigration quotas had to be observed. In the struggle between compassion and selfish laws, compassion lost. Neutral Switzerland went a bit farther than others. It sent its national police chief, Dr. Heinrich Rothmund, to Berlin with an infamous proposal to stamp all Jewish documents, passports, and IDs with the letter J for Jude, Jew. Thus, it would be easier for Switzerland and other concerned governments to know whom to accept and whom to reject. Soon after, a new tragedy struck Polish Jews residing in Germany. Until then, as foreign citizens, their situation was much better than that of their local brethren and sisters. German anti-Semite laws did not apply to them. I remember the story, of course. Berlin preferred not to stir up troubles on the international scene by harming foreign nationals, be they Jews. The Third Reich had prosperous commercial relations with many countries. Why endanger them? I remember the late Abraham Joshua Heschel telling me about frustration and pain that he had felt being better off, thanks to his Polish passport, than Jews in Frankfurt, where he taught at the Jewish Institute for Higher Learning. All that changed, however, when Warsaw, for reasons we don't know, chose to revoke the citizenship of all of its citizens who lived more than 5 years outside Poland. A special visa was imposed on all of them, and all met, therefore, with terrible difficulties. Overnight almost, 15,000 Polish Jews, men, women, and children, became stateless, therefore utterly unprotected. On October 28, 1938, all were expelled from the Third Reich to Poland, where they hadn't been for decades. Poland refused to let them in on the grounds that they were foreigners now. Several trains had brought them to Poland's borders. One of them disembarked its human cargo at a station named Zbożyn. The family Grinspan was among the exiled. And here are excerpts of a letter Herschel Grinspan in Paris received a few days later from his older sister, Bertha. And she says, "Dear Herschel, you must have heard about the disaster. I shall tell you what has happened. On Thursday evening, rumors were circulating that Polish Jews in our city were being expelled. None of us believed it. At 9 o'clock that evening, a policeman came to our house to tell us to report to the police station with our passports. We all trooped off, as we were, to the police station. Practically, the whole neighborhood was already there. Almost immediately, we were taken to the town hall in a police car. So was everyone else. No one told us what was up, but we realized that this was going to be the end. They shoved an expulsion order into our hands, saying we had to leave Germany before October 29th. We were not allowed to go home. I pleaded to be allowed to fetch a few things, and the policeman accompanied me. I packed the case with the most important clothes, but that was all we could salvage. We haven't a penny. Could you send us something at large? Love from all of us." 4 days later in Paris, Herschel Grinspan entered a shop for weapons and purchased a gun. He went to the German embassy, Rue de Lille, spoke to a secretary, a certain Monsieur Nagorka, who asked him the object of his visit. Herschel refused to answer. The man's position wasn't high enough. He wanted to speak to the ambassador himself, or at least to one of his aides. For he had, he said, an important document to show him. After a lengthy discussion, he was introduced into the office of the third secretary, Herr Ernst von Rath. The German diplomat wanted to see the document Herschel was supposed to possess. And the young Jew's response, from his pocket he drew a revolver and shouted, "In the name of 12,000 persecuted Jews, here is the document." And he fired 5 bullets into the German diplomat who collapsed. With his last strength, von Rath howled for help. Herschel could have escaped, but did not. He waited. Minutes later, while the wounded diplomat was taken to the hospital, his attacker was arrested by the French policeman, François Autret, on duty outside the embassy. He brought him to the police station. He denied nothing. "Yes," he said, "I fired 5 bullets on a man who was alone in his office. I did so to avenge my parents and other Jews who are oppressed and unhappy in Germany." Strangely, a German official was present at his interrogation at the French police station and even took part in it. He wanted to know more about his real motive. And Herschel repeated, "To avenge those who are persecuted by the Germans." "Why did you feel charged with this mission?" asked the German official. And Herschel answered, "Because I share the religious faith of the expelled." "Are you Jewish?" "Yes, I am," said Herschel. Actually, the police found in his pockets a postcard addressed to his parents in Zbozhin. "My dear parents, I couldn't act differently. May God forgive me. My heart bleeds when I hear of the tragedy of the 12,000 Jews. I must protest so the entire world hears my outcry. Please forgive me, Herschel." Later he will say again to the police, "It's not a crime to be Jewish. We are not dogs. The Jewish people has also the right to live." In the meantime, his victim, Ernst von Rath, lay in deep coma for 2 days. Well, what is the context? What was it in what Herschel learned in his youth to make him into an avenger? After all, he had a Jewish upbringing. He had learned the Bible. He wasn't a biblical student, but he learned, as every Jewish child has. What moved him? What inspired him? What example did he follow? Oh, yes, again, look, there were avengers. Of course, there were Pinchas, the high priest, and Elijah the prophet. But these were exceptions again. Vengeance was not part of it. The story with Amalek, the Amalekites, it doesn't affect the mentality, the sensitivity, the moral behavior of the Jewish person. Vengeance is not part of our collective psyche. But then, Herschel Greenspan was not the first political avenger. 2 years earlier, the leader of the Swiss Fascist Party, Wilhelm Gustloff, was assassinated by David Frankfurter, another young Jew, in Davos. But even earlier, there had been already another avenger, the first. In the year 1926, a young Russian-born Jew, Sholem Schwarzbart, a future poet and militant, stopped in the streets a Ukrainian immigrant in Paris. And that Ukrainian immigrant in Paris was the former Ukrainian president and warlord during and after the Soviet Revolution. Are you Simon Peteljura? Sholem Schwarzbart asked the man. And when the man answered, yes, Sholem pulled out a gun and killed him. Again, even then, like later on, Herschel, he didn't run away. He waited for the police to arrest him. That morning he had mailed, it was premeditation, that morning he had mailed a letter to the celebrated lawyer in Paris, Henri Torres, in which he told him of his decision to avenge the death of thousands of Jews in the Ukraine, and he asked him to be his defense attorney. A strange tale of an even stranger life. Born in Bessarabia, Sholem was born in 1886. At 20, active in the revolutionary movement, he fled to Paris and worked as a watchmaker. During World War I, he joined the Foreign Legion. His bravery won him the prestigious Croix de Guerre, or the War Cross. He returned with French troops to Odessa in 1917, where he collected facts and memories of Peteljura's troops' blood-chilling atrocities against thousands upon thousands of Jews. We know from history what they have done. Those pogroms reminded one of the Middle Ages. The case of Sholem Schwarzbart stirred the interest and passions among Jews and Gentiles, both in France and the United States. Everywhere, writers and humanists signed petitions in Sholem's favor. Ultimately, it was the attorney Henri Torres who succeeded in transforming the political criminal trial, not of the Jewish avenger, but of the pogroms in the Ukraine that had influenced his action. And Sholem Schwarzbart was declared by the jury not guilty. In France, they had then, maybe even today, something that they called a crime de passion, a crime of passion. There you go, free. And he was declared not guilty. As a free man, he traveled all over the world, fighting against anti-Semitism, racism, and for human rights. He died before Herschel Greenspan to save Jewish honor. Before Herschel Greenspan pulled the trigger. Now, are we to consider these two executions as comparable? No. Peteljura was personally guilty of mass murder. Von Rath was not. The German diplomat was chosen by Herschel as a symbol of and for the German tormentors, torturers, and murderers who had acted on behalf of Hitler's government and people. Von Rath himself had never killed anyone. He was not a member of the SS. In fact, rumors had it that he privately had opposed the Nazi regime. But the regime on its highest level decided to use the episode to punish all the Jews in Germany. So in hindsight, Herschel Greenspan's attitude could be understood. The suffering of others compels us to respond. The response may take on various forms. But compassion for the victims surely was an integral part of it. One may turn in such cases, of course, when someone is overcome by passion, by compassion for victims, one may turn towards God and plead for his help. One can also be so concerned with them and their plight that one could forget the perpetrators. But ultimately, in certain cases, one can choose violence as a response to violence. During the darkest hours of our history, in some ghettos and camps, Jews chose prayer and acceptation. It's simple. They were too weak to take up arms, which anyway they did not possess. But then there were uprisings. The post-war accusations that Jews went like sheep to slaughter, quote-unquote, instead of fighting were misplaced and false. There were Jewish groups that resisted even in Treblinka and Birkenau. Strange as it may sound, the first civil insurrection against what was then the mightiest army in the world took place in the Warsaw Ghetto. Chronicles of that time tell us that when the first ghetto fighters killed the first SS men, they would dance around their bodies. The reason? They just got proof that the enemy, too, was mortal. But vengeance? When the liberators entered prisons and death camps, they found inscriptions on the walls in Yiddish, brothers, remember, Nekome, Nem Nekome, be avengers, take vengeance. But there was no real vengeance. We shall speak about it later. Did Heschel hear that appeal before it was issued? Let's return to the cold day of November 7, 1938. For the moment, Heschel is in jail, and Vom Rath comatose, lies in the hospital. The French response is diplomatic. The government publishes a communique expressing its regrets about the attack on a foreign envoy on French soil. As for Germany, the immediate reaction is bombastic. Informed, Hitler sent to Paris his personal physicians, Dr. Karl Brandt, accompanied by a renowned specialist from Munich, Professor Georg Magnus. They tried their best, helped by local specialists, but Vom Rath dies in the afternoon of November 9. An official car takes the body to the frontier Aix-la-Chapelle, where a special train has been waiting to take him to Düsseldorf, a national funeral attended by Hitler, von Ribbentrop, and Rudolf Hess is being held. Flowers, eulogies, speeches. A military orchestra plays Beethoven's funeral march. And Joseph Goebbels in Berlin is preparing his own response, to what official Germany now calls the Jewish conspiracy against the Third Reich. He planned it in every detail. Who should do what and where and to whom? It will be remembered as Germany's vengeance against what the Jews have done through Herschel Greenspan. During that night in Stuttgart, the 29-year-old teacher Felix David committed suicide. Ruth, his young wife, committed suicide. Their two babies, Benjamin and Gideon, were found dead next to their parents. Was it fear? Protest? Was it their way of saying goodnight to Hitler's Germany and to the whole world? Everywhere the Nazi tormentors tried to show their inventiveness, their fantasy, in torturing their Jewish victims. In Baden-Baden, for instance, all the Jews were marched to the synagogue behind a Star of David saying, God, do not abandon us. In one city, Jews were all led to the synagogue where they were ordered to sing the repulsive Nazi song, the Horst Wessel Lied, in the synagogue. A prominent Jew had to ascend the Bima and read aloud a passage from Mein Kampf instead of reading the Torah. But why such hatred towards Jews? Why such nastiness towards whatever Jews consider sacred? Why the synagogues? Why the Holy Scrolls? What is it in those that inspired such fear in the killers? From eyewitnesses, we heard that the general population supported the pogrom, or at least did not oppose it. How many doors were opened for hunted down Jews? How many families chose to offer shelter to Jewish children? How many men and women rushed to the burning synagogues to save holy scrolls? Oh, there must have been good, some good, courageous clergymen who spoke up in anger. And we must remember them with gratitude. But there were not many, just a harmful. 815 Jewish stores were destroyed and pillaged in every major city in Germany. It was the worst national pogrom in history. 275 houses of study and prayer were set aflame. A much higher figure has also been retained. More than 100 Jews were slain. Some 30,000 were sent to Dachau, Buchenwald, and Sachsenhausen. When the pogrom was over, a high-level conference headed by Hermann Göring himself and Goebbels on the agenda, Kristallnacht. And the question, believe it or not, sounds stupid and comical. The question was, its organizers have taught and foreseen every aspect of the pogrom except one. In destroying and looting so many Jewish businesses and buildings, they forgot that most of them carried insurance from foreign insurance agencies. And therefore, they thought, Germany might be forced to pay them in much-needed foreign courtesy. Wouldn't it mean that the Jews lost too little? But Germany too? For 3 hours, Germany's leaders discussed money. Do not worry, said Göring. His solution? He will publish a decree canceling the insurance contracts. But who will pay for the mountains of the broken glass? One participant was eager to know. Not to worry, replied Göring. The damage done to the Jews will be covered by the Jews. The Jews had to pay for the broken glass broken by the enemy. Then the discussion turned to a different direction. What could be done so that Jewish passengers would not disturb aliens in the train? It's simple, someone suggested. The Jews will be given one wagon for themselves. What? Exclaimed another. Suppose the train is full and the Jewish wagon half empty. Why should they be more comfortable than German passengers? Okay, laughed someone. And he suggested, put them in toilets. The highest level of government, having just completed the Kristallnacht, the worst pogrom operation in history. So remember again, the Wehrmacht had just decided to occupy Czechoslovakia and prepared itself to war with Poland and perhaps, of course, later with France and Great Britain. And there, in Göring's office, the number two man of the hierarchy, all high-ranking officials were concerned with was Jewish train travel and broken glass and insurance. Later, a few years later, some Jews will be made to pay for their one-day ticket to Auschwitz. We desire only one thing, Goebbels wrote in his Völkische Beobachter, that the world became sufficiently fellow-Semitic so as to help us get rid of all our Jews. Disregard the irony and just think of its implications. Let's not forget, in those early times, Hitler's goal was not yet the final solution, but evacuation. That would become Eichmann's first major task, to find ways, at that time, legal or not, to help Jews immigrate from Germany. But too many governments were afraid of being compelled to welcome Jewish refugees. Scandinavian countries invoked their neutrality. In London, Prime Minister Chamberlain continued to preach rapprochement with Berlin, even considering to offer Britain's colonies to the Third Reich. Appeasement was the name of his political philosophy. However, public opinion was against him. In an open letter to the Times, the Archbishop of Canterbury protested against the horror of Kristallnacht. I quote him, "Whatever could have been the provocation by the deplorable action of the young irresponsible Jew, one cannot justify such ferocious reprisals on such a scale." In France, reactionary papers led by Charles Maurras urged the government not to open the frontiers even larger. There were enough Jews in the country already. But liberal publications unanimously expressed the indignation and said so with great dignity. But what happened to Herschel Greenspan in the meantime? In jail, he was awaiting trial. His statement to the investigating judge was, I quote him, "I was not motivated by hatred or vengeance. I was motivated only by the love for my father and my people who have endured unbearable suffering. I deeply regret having injured anyone, but I have no other way of expressing myself." He was indicted for premeditated murder and was defended by a very, very great lawyer called Moreau de Giafferi, who with Henri Torres, the same who had defended Sholem Schwarzbart, and later David Frankfurter, they were then now the lawyers of and for Herschel Greenspan. Thanks to the worldwide media, particularly in America, inspired by a highly respected and influential journalist, Dorothy Thompson, Herschel Greenspan's deed was discussed everywhere with great sympathy. The defense planned to bring Herschel's family to the witness stand. Court-appointed psychiatrists concluded that he was sane and responsible for his actions. Weeks and months came and went. People everywhere were awaiting the trial with curiosity and anxiety. But that no trial date had been set. Von Rath's father came to Paris and was interrogated by the examining magistrate. And still no date for the trial could be found. The more Germany pressed for it, the less success it obtained. At one point, just before the outbreak of World War II, chances for the opening of the trial increased. But then Germany asked for a postponement sine die. When the Wehrmacht entered Paris, the Gestapo's first priority was to seize Herschel Greenspan, but he wasn't there anymore. First he had been transferred to one prison, then to another. Then the French prison authorities didn't know what to do with him, so they let him go free. He, strangely, was afraid of freedom. So he continued his wanderings until he reached a prison in Toulouse, where he went to hand himself over to the prison authorities, and finally he was accepted. It is there that the Gestapo, following a long search, found him. The Petain government didn't wait long to hand him over to the German occupant. The prisoner was immediately transferred to the Gestapo headquarters in Berlin. He stayed there until January 1941, when he was transferred to Sachsenhausen. In the meantime, Goebbels thought of staging a spectacular show trial proving that world Jewry is capable of such vengeance against Germany, and that there was a conspiracy involving the highest authorities of Judaism. But then all of a sudden he gave up the idea, and no one knows the real reason for that bizarre decision. Was it because the German law forbade trying a stateless person for committing crimes abroad? Never imagine something that happened like that. They found ways to overcome that obstacle. Another hypothesis was that Goebbels had planned to summon French statesmen as witnesses for the prosecution and failed to obtain their consent. Still another theory maintains that Herschel Greenspan was actually planning to plead that his crime was not political but sentimental, namely that he had maintained a homosexual relationship with his victim, Ernst von Rath. And Goebbels felt that would be a blemish on the reputation of Germany, that a simple Jew should be sexually involved with a German high aristocratic. No. Anyway, we don't know for sure why there was no trial. What happened then? Where was Herschel Greenspan murdered? Some say that he was beheaded in the Moabit Pit prison. Others say that he was murdered in Sachsenhausen, but nobody knows for sure. During the Eichmann trial, at one point, the prosecutor called to the witness stand Herschel Greenspan's father. People forgot about the father. Since the war, he wasn't mentioned anywhere, and they called him. You can imagine the shiver that went through the courtroom. And he spoke. And then Herschel Greenspan was remembered again. I have a question, of course. Oh, we know so many things now, so many more things about that period. I'll give you an example. When you read what the Germans have done, when they have confiscated so many of the Jewish wealth and bank accounts and fortunes, all of a sudden I found out that it's confiscated in Jewish homes, they confiscated weapons. What? 2,000. Nearly 2,000 weapons. Weapons? In Jewish homes? Why should they keep weapons? One would say, maybe they hunters. No, no. There's a very famous story, Walter Rathenau, German foreign minister, killed then, a Jew. And he was invited at one point, an official visit somewhere, where the president of state had official hunting parties. And when he was invited, he, Walter Rathenau, said, oh no, I'm sorry. I belong to a people who is hunted, not hunting. So why should there be weapons there? Is it possible that they tried, I don't know what, some resistance? I don't know. But the whole story contains a lot of mysteries that have not been really answered yet. I come back to the question from earlier, what I raised already. I don't believe in vengeance. Vengeance is an individual act that maybe satisfies the avenger on the moment. It doesn't prove anything. It doesn't show anything. I do believe in justice. And I have tremendous respect for justice, but not for vengeance. But I ask myself, how come really that in 1945 we were spared that temptation? The Talmud says, marvelous, Talmud says, Bishloshadvarim Hadam Nika, these are the three things that could define a human being. The way he behaves, because so when he's drunk, because so with money, or because so when he's angry. I ask myself, what happened to our anger? Forget hate. I'm against hate, too. I don't believe in it. But what happened to anger? Where was Jewish anger? At that time, at one point, the Jewish Brigade, they tried to plan some kind of thing, but it didn't work out. It fizzled out right away. Where was Jewish anger? And the only reason The only explanation that I have is hatred leads a person to more hatred. Anger can be positive. Occasionally I am angry. When I witness an injustice and I cannot help it, I'm angry at myself too, that I cannot help. But I am angry. I see racist, I'm angry. I've said it many times, I'm saying it again, I should say it again. When I came to America in 1956 and I crisscrossed America with friends and I came to the South and I saw racism at work. And not only at work. When I saw in the South racism being the law, for the first time in my life that I felt shame. I never felt shame for being Jewish, but then I felt shame for being white. White. Later I went to South Africa to fight apartheid. 1975, going from city to city. Because again, apartheid is the law. The law was inhuman, not only unfair and unjust, inhuman, unlawful. The law was guilty. So anger, yeah. And anger then must be channeled in the right way. In 1945, in the case of the Jewish people, that anger was channeled towards building a new state. Oh, I'm sure that the leaders didn't foresee all that happened later. I know the problems. Believe me, I know. I know the complexity. I know the suffering of the others. I know. But in 1945, they had to channel that much anger. And that's why history created the Jewish state, the state of Israel. What is the lesson of all that? The lesson, my young students, we are here again in a hall of learning. And whatever the question, the major component of the answer must be learning and more learning. What I have learned in my life is not only to respect my teachers, it's normal, not only to respect my fellow teachers, but my colleagues, but to respect my students. This is the law by Maimonides. Of course, but to say to a student, respect your teacher, it's normal. But the teacher must respect the students. But I'm learning a lot. I have learned a lot yesterday and today, a little lesson tomorrow, those of you who come to the conferences. And I must tell you, there's something very special about all that. To be together with those who believe in the same quest, a quest for memory that brings surely not hate, but that brings hope. For one another, with one another. Thank you.
This is WBUR. You've just heard a lecture by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture was titled Kristallnacht. Introducing Professor Wiesel was Boston University President Emeritus John Silber. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Jim Kiesling. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.